This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
My name's Carolyn Schabowski, and I have been teaching here in the school for the past 21 years, and my specialty is oral medicine. And I will tell you all about actually what we do in that specialty. So oral medicine basically deals with diagnosis and management of disease of soft tissue in the mouth. So we actually don't really deal with teeth. We deal with oral mucosa, salivary gland, glands, and any related structure. So we really function at the interface of dentistry and medicine. There are lots of systemic diseases that actually have a manifestation in the mouth. And so that's what we do. And examples of these systemic diseases may be HIV/AIDS or other type of immune deficiencies, Sjögren syndrome, certain blood dyscrasias, certain autoimmune diseases. So we basically provide diagnostic and treatment services to lots of outpatients, but also hospital-based patients. And so we interface with specialties like oncology, rheumatology, endocrinology, infectious diseases, derm or dermatology, and transplant medicine. And so I'm going to actually go over, let me show you my outline. I'm going to tell you how we basically work up a patient, how we basically come up with a differential diagnosis when we're in clinic, how we collect the history and how we examine the mouth, and how we come about the differential diagnosis, how we collect a oral mucosal biopsy, although not every single disease will require a biopsy to be diagnosed. And then I'll give you a couple of examples of clinical cases. And I'm actually going to use the format that we use with our students. How do we go about a history, and how do we present cases? We try these days to teach what we call evidence-based or case-based medicine or dentistry. And so we actually teach mainly using cases in the specialty of oral medicine. So I will basically provide them with a history, and then I'll put them on the spot and say, well, so what do you want to know from this patient? And what's the next question we should ask? And then we sort of go through the case until I show them basically pictures of the case, and then we work through the differential diagnosis. So I will show you pictures that you may find quite different from pictures you've seen, you've seen before, because you know sometimes certain disease of the mouth can have lots of ulcerations or lots of sort of hyperplastic tissue. And so just to warn you, if you felt like taking a snack out during the presentation, you may not really want to do that. So basically, there are lots of different pieces to getting to a differential diagnosis. And it's actually interesting how students will typically, so we have third-year dental students rotate through our clinic. So we have a clinic on the sixth floor here in the Clinical Science Building that's been existing since 1956. Some of you may have heard the name Sol Silverman. So Sol Silverman was one of the sort of pioneers in oral medicine, and he founded this clinic in 1956. So you can imagine, with such a clinic that's been existing for so many years, we have quite a referral base, and we see a large number of patients. Sometimes our patients come from Stockton, Fresno. I mean, we're sort of the only referral clinic, the only oral medicine clinic in this area, and for most of Northern California. And then the next one will be in Los Angeles. So essentially, this is not the type of clinical specialty which most dentists would practice in a private practice setting. Usually, it's basically practiced within a dental school or a medical center, and not that it cannot be practiced outside, but it's I think most dentists feel that a business type practice is probably easier to have if you do general dentistry and procedures than if you spend a lot of time basically diagnosing and managing. So we have third year dental students spend a whole week with us, and they're all essentially in their first year of clinic. So the way dental education works, typically the first 2 years, they learn about teeth. I mean, they get lots of didactic lectures. And then in the last 2 years, they're in the clinic. So they come to us when they're in their first year in the clinic. And very often, even though they've obviously had a lecture that tells them in what order to present things, they're always very eager to look in the mouth. And they're always very eager when the attending, so when I come in the room and they're expected to present the patient to me, they'll immediately say, oh, this patient has this big ulcer and it looks like this, and they won't start with a history. And in fact, 80% of the diagnosis is in the history. So you could have, basically 10, pictures of 10 cases that could look, actually could have a lot of similarities, but could be completely different diseases based on the history. So history is really extremely important. So first of all, what is the chief complaint? And by chief complaint, we mean what is the reason the patient is coming? The history of present illness. How long has the problem been there? Has it changed since onset? Has it responded to some kind of treatment? The medical history, of course, is very important, especially because oral medicine deals with lots of systemic diseases that have manifestations in the mouth. So it's very important for us to know about patients' medical history, what medications they're taking. Obviously, there are vital signs. Social history, are there smokers? Do they drink alcohol? How much? Family history, dental history. And once we've actually gone through all these different elements, we get to the examination. And then we obviously do an extra oral examination, intraoral examination, and then we get an impression for what it might be, or we make a differential diagnosis. And then once we have a differential diagnosis, we come up with a plan. So the chief complaint basically is the reason for the visit. Who is referring the patient, and what are the symptoms described by the patient? So examples could be, we have a 45-year-old man referred by dentist for evaluation of a white lesion on the tongue, and it's asymptomatic. Or you could have a 72-year-old woman referred by her physician for evaluation of a painful mass on the palate or on the roof of mouth. Or you could have a 55-year-old woman self-referred due to burning tongue or lips and lips. And self-referred, people sometimes find us actually online. Or they find us in the registry for UCSF. But most of the time, I would say 99% of our patients are referred either by their physician or by their dentist. So the history of present illness, essentially, we want to know how long the condition's been there. Has it changed since it appeared? And has any prior treatment been rendered? And what has been the potential response? And sometimes all of this is unknown because maybe the patient went to his or her dentist the week before. The dentist saw something that the patient had not noticed. And if it was a whole year since the patient had his prior visit to his dentist, he might not know how long it's been there. So examples, if we talk about our asymptomatic white lesion on the tongue, could have been there for 3 months, no change in size or appearance, and maybe an antifungal was prescribed by the dentist and there's been no response. And an antifungal is a medication basically to treat yeast infections. So then we go to the medical history, and of course we review the medical history form that's filled out by the patient, and you've all filled out medical history form when you go to your physician or to your dentist or to any kind of healthcare provider, and we ask about past and current systemic conditions. We record all the current medications. We record any known allergies, and then we collect some vital signs. And this is just an example of a medical history form. You know, sometimes they're one page, other time they're a little. Now, more and more often, patients actually fill this out online. So we have more and more of these electronic medical history form. Social history, we ask them basically about the history of smoking. And what we're interested in is essentially the cumulative exposure over a lifetime. So they may have quit smoking 20 years ago. If they smoke 2 packs a day for 20 years, they've had a pretty big cumulative exposure. And we teach our students to basically multiply the number of packs per day by the number of years smoked. So a 40-pack year history could be somebody who smoked 2 packs a day for 20 years or 1 pack a day for 40 years. And what matters is actually the cumulative exposure. Now, we ask about past and current use of recreational drug, of alcohol, and the reason we want to know this is because both alcohol and cigarette smoking are pretty important risk factors for oral cancer. And so it is, you know, we do want to try to assess risk of oral cancer. However, we will do the same sort of comprehensive examination of the mouth whether or not there is a risk factor. In other words, we certainly see plenty of oral cancers in patients who don't have any risk factors. So it's you can't just basically, base your exam on the risk factor. And this is particularly important because, and actually for all of you, when you go to your dentist, essentially at every single sort of periodic oral exam, so you might go to the dentist every 6 months, or you might go to the dentist sometimes once a year, but every time you go for that sort of periodic exam, you should get a soft tissue exam. And a soft tissue exam, the dentist basically, and you'll see what a soft tissue exam is, the dentist should be kind of pulling up your lip, look at your tongue, right and left. It doesn't take a long time. It takes about 3 minutes, frankly, 3 to 5 minutes. But if that's not done, you can't see if there's something wrong with the tongue or the palate or something else. If the dentist is only looking at the teeth, basically he or she can't see what's going on with the soft tissue. So this, you know, no matter what your age is or your risk factor, whether you smoke or not, you want to get a soft tissue exam when you go to your dentist. So we record some family history, basically whether or not the parents are still alive and well, or if they died, what cause, and then some chronic diseases that are in the family. Then we want to know if the patient has a regular dentist and how long it's been since he or she saw their dentist. And then we get to the examination. So first we'll do an extra oral examination and we'll palpate the neck and the submandibular area to try to find, to detect any what we call lymphadenopathy. So lymphadenopathy is basically swollen lymph nodes. And we look for any facial asymmetry or swelling. We also look for the parotid glands, and I'll show you on the pictures where these are. And we look for enlargement of those parotid glands. And the parotid glands are basically the largest salivary glands that we have. And we also have some submandibular glands. Then we'll get to the intraoral examination, and we ask the student to describe what you see. What is the color? What is the size? What is the character? Is it flat? Is it raised? Is it a mass? Is it hard? And where is it? Is it located just in one spot in the mouth? Or is it generalized to the entire mouth? So this is basically the chronology that we use to do this extra and intraoral examinations. And we first look at the face, you know, the contour, look for symmetry. Then we look at the lips, and we teach our students to always follow the same sequence, because very often patients will tell you, oh, I have this big ulcer on my tongue, and they're really eager to show you their tongue. And if you start by looking at that, then you often forget to look at the rest. So we really want our providers to always follow the same sequence and to resist looking where the patient is pointing. You want to basically do a systematic exam, and that's kind of the order of the exam. So we start out with palpating the neck, and those are essentially the main sort of chain of lymph nodes that we look for, as well as a submandibular lymph node. And we do that by palpating. So we cup our fingers right underneath the submandibular area here. And we want the patient actually to be sitting up. If they are laying down, like on a dental chair, it's a lot harder to feel their neck. So we want them to, on our chairs, we want them to sit up so that we can palpate their neck. And then we do the same thing along the neck area. So Then we look at what we call the parotid glands. And the parotid glands basically extend from the sort of upper border of the auricular orifice here to the corner of the jaw. And they're basically right here. And if you look at this patient from the profile, you can see pretty much the sort of the extent of the parotid gland. Now, you can't see the parotid gland when it's not prominent. But in somebody who has parotid gland enlargement, all of a sudden you would start seeing kind of a bulge on the side of the face in that area. And then you want to assess, is that bulge soft, hard, is it symmetrical, or is it asymmetrical? Then we start looking, we want to look at the lips. Before patients open their mouths, we want to look at the contour of the lips, and we call this part here the vermilion of the lip, and this is the vermilion border. And then we look at the commissures. And you may have noticed that if you spend a lot of time in the sun, essentially later in life, you can sort of lose a lot of that vermilion border. If you look at a child's mouth, there's kind of a big lip between the skin and the lip, but there's a big edge. If you spend a lot of time in the sun, this edge here starts fading, and there is less and less essentially sort of difference between the chin, I mean the skin area, and the lip itself, and that's from sun damage. So, and that's something we look for, because if we see a lot of sun damage in our patient's lips, we really want them to start using very high protection chapstick to make sure that they don't go on and develop sun damage, which can lead to lip cancer. So the way we're going to look at the inside of the patient's lip, first of all, we're going to stretch a lip out over the chin. And when we do that, and you may have done that with your own lip, you might notice that if you touch the lower lip with your tongue and you feel the inside of the lower lip, you feel like a lot of little grains. It almost feels like little grains of rice that are stuck under the lips. And those are thousands and thousands of minor salivary glands. So we have big salivary glands, major salivary glands, the parotid, the submandibular, the sublingual. And then we have a whole bunch of minor salivary glands that are basically mainly in the lower lip. We have some in the upper lip, but we mainly have some in the lower lip. And sometimes these salivary glands, or one of these, can get damaged. So, for example, if you bit yourself, the little duct that typically brings saliva out to the mouth might get cut, and or it might get clogged. And if saliva can't go out from the minor salivary gland to the mouth and it stays stuck inside, you will get what's called a mucocele, and you'll get kind of a big lump right here, like a big swelling that's full of fluid. And it might kind of rupture, it might pop, and it might empty. But because the little duct is cut, it'll actually come back. And these typically have to be surgically removed. We have to remove that little salivary gland, because otherwise it'll continue to basically fill up and pop, fill up and pop. And it can do that for a number of months. So we look at the lower lip, then we look at the upper lip. We do the same thing. We stretch it over the nose. And we look at the color, we look at the sort of texture. It should be nice and pink. There shouldn't be any difference in color when you look at it. Sometimes you might see sort of an intense redness. Then you know that there is some kind of inflammation going on. Or you might see a lot of white plaques, and that will be the sign that something else is going on. So it should be basically the same color as the sort of the rest of the mouth, and it should be sort of nice and pink. We look at these frenum here, and then the little fold here between the lip and the gingiva is called the vestibule. Then we're going to look at what we call the buccal mucosa. That's the inside of the cheek. And now you may wonder what this is. This is basically just a retractor that we use to sort of stretch the patient's cheek so that we can take a picture, because otherwise we wouldn't be able to take a picture. And so this is basically just a little cheek retractor. And usually we have the patient hold the retractor themselves, so it's not, you know, it's not a horrible device that stretches their mouth. I mean, it's something that they have control over. They can hold it, you know, any way they want, as long as we get enough light to take the picture. And pictures are incredibly important in our field. I mean, you know, a picture is worth 1,000 words. And basically, I pretty much take pictures on everything I see that is abnormal. So obviously, these are pictures of a normal exam because I'm demonstrating how to do a soft tissue exam. But it's really important to have good documentation of what's going on in somebody's mouth. So if you have a picture, you can actually compare the baseline exam, the first time the patient comes in, with maybe when they come in 3 months later. And it's really nice to have that comparison. So this here inside, so this is the buccal mucosa, the inside of the cheek. And right here, you see what looks like this little tissue tag. That's what we call the Stenson's duct. And it's basically the duct that brings out the saliva from the parotid gland. And sometimes that can be quite prominent. It can actually get quite red, or it can actually, you can all of a sudden get some sort of oozing. Instead of having clear saliva coming out of there, you can all of a sudden see sort of pus come out. That means that there is some kind of infection going on in the parotid gland. Maybe the patient has some kind of salivary stone that blocks the duct. And if there is a stone blocking the duct, all of a sudden saliva basically kind of stays in the parotid gland. And then you can actually get bacterial growth, and you can get a swollen gland, and we call that sialadenitis. Basically, that's a swollen salivary gland. And the way this duct looks, and obviously the way that you examined the patient's parotid gland, are clinical signs that you use to diagnose this kind of condition. So then we look, obviously, at the buccal mucosa on each side. We also look at the vestibules. And you want to make sure that you retract the cheek. Now, typically, here it's retracted with a cheek retractor, but when we do our exam, we just retract it with a regular mirror. But you want to make sure you get your mirror all the way in back so you can see what's going on in the vestibule on the back of the mouth. Then we're going to look at the palate, and the roof of the mouth basically has a hard palate, which is, you know, this tissue covering bone. And then in the back of your palate, you have essentially, if you say ah, you start seeing that part that's vibrating, that's the soft palate. And so we examine all these different parts of the palate, and at the sort of middle of the soft palate, you'll see the uvula, and you also we'll see the palatoglossal arch and the fossae. And the palatoglossal arch, it's not unusual to write basically around the fossae here, kind of at each edge or each side of the soft palate, you might see a red patch, and it's symmetrical. That's because we have a lot of lymphoid tissue there. So we have what's called the Waldeyer's ring, which is a whole ring of lymphoid tissue. And lymphoid tissue is what makes out tonsils, and it's supposed to defend us. So basically, we have this ring of lymphoid tissue that's right at the beginning, essentially, of the, you know, the esophagus and the ear and the windpipe, so that essentially it can help defend you against certain aggressions. So then we're going to look at the tongue. And the tongue has a lot of what we call filiform papillae. And you see this little sort of mat of you know, they almost look like tiny little hairs. And then within these filiform papillae, you have little bumps there. And these are what's called the fungiform papillae, and they contain the taste buds. So we have lots of taste buds on our tongue. And they are basically, in this sort of whole island of filiform papillae. And the reason I'm pointing all these things out, because you'll see that sometimes something goes wrong with these, and then all of a sudden the tongue looks quite, quite different. So we also want to look at the side of the tongue, and we'll take a piece of gauze here to basically pull out the tongue so we can see the sort of back of it. And if you pull it far enough, you're going to see a lot of little lumps and bumps back there. And these are, we call them the foliate papillae, but it's also a bunch of lymphoid tissue. And essentially, it's kind of the tip of our lingual tonsils. So you're all familiar with your palatine tonsils, the tonsils that you can kind of see if you open your mouth real wide. Well, we also have lingual tonsils. They're right at the base of tongue. You can't see the lingual tonsils, but the tissue which is right there is kind of the tip of the iceberg of the lingual tonsils. And that's why it's all bumpy. And sometimes you know, physicians don't spend a lot of time looking inside the patient's mouth. They actually very rarely look in the patient's mouth. And when they look, they might just look at the tongue. They won't really kind of pull the tongue back and look. And it's not unusual that sometimes patients will show, they'll see these little bumps in the back of their mouth, and they'll say, oh, this doesn't, they've never looked there before. So they think that this is something abnormal. And they'll show it to their doctor, and the doctor say, well, you know, they usually don't look back there. So we've actually sometimes had patients referred because they had lots of bumps in the back of their mouth. But these bumps are completely normal. And except if they start looking really red, if one side looks very different than the other, then there might be something there. But basically, if it's really bumpy on both sides, that's the way it's supposed to look. And again, this lymphoid tissue, the tons of lymphocytes. Lymphocytes are the cells in our body that are basically meant to defend us. They're part of our immune system. We look at the ventral tongue, basically the underneath the tongue, and we often see lots of blood vessels. And if somebody is taking a baby aspirin a day, which is very common in the general population, many of us take a baby aspirin a day, these might become quite prominent. And sometimes you might even see little, little sort of red patches because there is a bit more. The aspirin basically is a blood thinner, and so you get little broken blood vessels underneath the tongue. And we look at the floor of mouth, and we actually will palpate the floor of mouth. And underneath here, underneath the tongue, in the floor of mouth, when you palpate down there, you can actually feel the sort of sublingual salivary glands. And again, if all of a sudden one side is much more prominent than the other, or you feel a big lump or a big mass, then we want to explore that. We want to explore that further. Now, if you look at the patient, now, when you go to your dentist, you probably all remember the dentist examining your teeth, and then they take a little periodontal explorer, and they sort of check, you know, they measure the little sulcus kind of that's around each tooth, and they count numbers. Well, so we don't do that, because that's what you get when the general dentist examines your mouth. But we do want to get a general picture of what the gums look like. And if you get a picture of somebody who's basically like this patient here is closing his teeth together, you can see there is a lot of difference in color between what's called the attached gingiva. So that's the gum that's actually attached to the bone, and then it looks a little bit whitish. And then the adjacent tissue, which is the mucosa, now this tissue up here is not attached to bone, so it actually looks a lot darker, but that's just because it's not attached to bone. So this patient's mouth here is completely normal. This basically, we expect to see a paler color when the tissue is attached to bone than the adjacent mucosa. And we obviously look also at the inside, you know, where the tongue is. We also look at the gums there. And then we know that when patients have darker skin, so in somebody who has dark skin, we often will see a lot of pigmentation, and we call that physiologic pigmentation. And we can see that on the gingiva, or we can see that on the buccal mucosa, or we can see that on the tongue. So I'm just going to list a few of what we call common oral conditions, but that don't really have any clinical significance. So they're not really diseases. They might look actually like a disease, but they're basically just kind of a slight departure from normal, but they're not, you know, they're not symptomatic, and they're not really a problem. They could be a symptom of a behavior that can become a problem, but in themselves, they're not really an issue. So sometimes when patients clench their teeth, you can see quite a bit of scalloping on the edge of the tongue, or you can see what's called a pronounced linea alba, which is kind of a white line on each cheek. And I'll show you some pictures of this. People can have what's called a geographic tongue, and the geographic tongue is essentially, we don't really know what's causing it, but about 20% of the population has a geographic tongue, and this should actually be an A for bald, not bold. It should be bald. And you see these sort of depapillated patches, and it almost looks like a map, which is probably why it's called geographic tongue. And each of these little bald, depopulated area often is surrounded by a little white rim, and these actually move around. If you look at that tongue 2 weeks later, well, the little bald spots might kind of move around. So it's all, we also call it stomatitis migrans. And I'll show you some pictures of geographic tongues. Typically, it doesn't bother patients. Sometimes it, because of the irregularities and the areas that are depapillated, you can have a little bit of fungal overgrowth. So you can have a yeast called Candida overgrow in the mouth a little bit in those areas. And then all of a sudden, that geographic tongue can actually become slightly burning. But typically, it just looks sort of peculiar, but it doesn't. It's not considered a disease per se. Now, other times, we can get what's called elongated filiform papillae, the small papillae that I showed you before, the filiform papillae that cover the tongue. Well, if somebody has really dry mouth or certain medications can cause these to actually grow, and all of a sudden you almost get like these little hair-like projections from the tongue. And then if somebody drinks a lot of tea or coffee, they can get stained. So actually, we call it black hairy tongue because you basically get a little mat of elongated filiform papillae that are stained, and it actually looks like hair. And I'll tell you more about what we do about it when I show some pictures. Fordyce granules are little ectopic sebaceous glands that are typically inside the cheeks, and I'll show you what that looks like. A condition called leukodema, which is kind of a white film on the inside of the cheek, but that disappears once we stretch the cheek. So again, it looks slightly different. Sometimes patients are referred for this because their physician or even sometimes their dentist doesn't recognize it as something that's kind of within normal limits. But leukodema is also, it's not considered a disease. And then we can have exostoses. And exostoses, I call them the bunions of the mouth because they're essentially little bony protuberances in the mouth. And you can have them in the middle of the palate, or you can actually have them grow on the jaw. And I'll show you what these look like. So this is a scallop tongue. And you can see that this is basically an impression of the teeth. The patient clenches their teeth, and then the tongue is pushing on those teeth because the tongue, you know, feels like being more free in the mouth. And that causes the scalloping here. So, again, the patients in time may have a problem because the teeth may actually sometimes crack or the teeth may become quite worn. But the tongue itself, it's not going to basically be an issue because it's scalloped. But it's... You know, if somebody does a lot of teeth clenching, the dentist may want to make them, a night guard so that they don't wear their teeth too much or they don't end up cracking them. Then you see this little discrete white line. So we all have this little white line inside our cheek. And then sometimes also in somebody who is clenching their teeth, it can become quite pronounced. So again, the cheek gets sucked in on the occlusal line, and it causes essentially this little white line. Now, why is it white? Because the tissue has a way of kind of shielding itself. So if the tissue is constantly getting sucked in next to the teeth, there's friction. And basically with friction, it's going to stimulate what's called keratin production. So keratin is something that we have on our nails, on our hair, actually our skin. The skin on our body has keratin. But the inside of our mouth, the inside of our cheek, basically is not supposed to have keratin. However, the tissue is capable of producing it. And if it gets attacked, if it gets solicited by friction or by sort of repeated pressure, then it's going to produce keratin, and that's why it looks white like this. So this is an example of a geographic tongue, and so you can see why I call these bald areas. So see how here you have the filiform papillae? That's actually the way the tongue's supposed to look, and now in this area, there's no papillae. See, this area is depapillated, and then it is surrounded by kind of a little white rim. And this is going on sort of elsewhere in the tongue. So this is an example of a geographic tongue. again, if, you know, the patient's never really looked at their tongue and they've never noticed this, and all of a sudden they look and they see this, they often panic thinking, oh, there's something really wrong with my tongue. But that's just the way that person's tongue look. And actually, that's kind of the way the tongue will always look. It can be more or less pronounced. So, for example, here's an example of much milder geographic tongue. So you can see that here the depapillation is much more discreet. But nevertheless, that's another form of geographic tongue. Sometimes when patients have geographic tongue, they have fissures. So here you see the little bald area, kind of, depapillated area with a white rim. And then here, look at these fissures. Now, again, that's just the way this person's tongue look. It's not a disease. But what can happen is that candida is what we call a commensal. It's a commensal organism. If this entire room were to spit each in a tube and we were to culture the saliva from that tube, probably we would find candida in about 30% of you. Doesn't mean you have a yeast infection. Doesn't mean you have candidiasis. It just means candida basically lives in your saliva. However, if all of a sudden, you know, you have a condition that allows that candida to overgrow, then you can get a yeast infection. You can get overgrowth of that candida, and that it can cause some problems. So these little fissures here are kind of perfect little, deep, dark areas where the candida would love to basically get down there and overgrow. So somebody who has a fissured tongue might complain of a burning tongue because they get a little bit of candida overgrowth. And that we would want to treat by giving them medication that would essentially get rid of the candida. So this is what I described to you as black hairy tongue. So you see in the back. So see here how this sort of coating. These are very long filiform papillae, and then in the back of the tongue, these filiform papillae have stained. Maybe because this person drinks a lot of coffee or tea, and it's basically just a stained elongated filiform papillae. And it might go away by itself. This is often because somebody has a dry mouth, or maybe they're taking a medication that will cause this to happen. Or sometimes we actually have to physically kind of get rid of this. I mean, some patients really do not like to have this in the back of their mouth. So we can take kind of an exfoliating agent and sort of put it on the tongue and then just kind of scrape it off. That's not very pleasant. So here we have Fordyce granules. So Fordyce granules are these little ectopic sebaceous glands. And again, you could look at this buccal mucosa and say, oh my God, what's wrong with this patient's mouth? It's got all these white spots. No, these are just little ectopic sebaceous glands. And if you look enough inside people's mouth, if you do this, for many years and you do it all the time, you learn to recognize, basically, to make the distinction between these here, that are just little ectopic sebaceous glands and that do not cause any harm, and then white plaques or white-type lesions that you need to worry about. And this is what we call leukodema, which is this white film. And again, why do patients have that? So if we were to biopsy this area, we would actually find sort of a lot of space between the cells, and it's not a problem, but it just gives it this look of a white film, and if we stretch it, it basically goes away. And then finally, my bony protuberances here, my exostoses. So typically when they're in the middle of the palate like this, so this is a patient's roof of mouth, and see right in the middle of the palate, you have this big palatal torus, then we call it a torus. But when they're at the edge like this, so this is also the patient's roof of mouth, and you can see at each edge of the palate, you get some exostoses. So we call them exostoses when they're anywhere else but in the middle of the palate. And they don't really cause a problem. Now, here are some very large ones. You can see these lingual exostoses. The only time these would be a problem is if all of a sudden this patient lost some teeth and needed a denture or a partial denture. Then you can imagine to try to build a partial denture, kind of getting around these exostoses would be an issue. Also, sometimes they get traumatized. So, how if you ever scrape your knuckle it takes a long time for the knuckle to heal. It's not like just having a clean cut, right? It's going to take a while because the tissue needs to kind of re-epithelialize from the edges. Same thing happens on these exostoses. If you eat like a chip and you get, you know, you get some little ulcer there, it can actually take weeks to heal because it's like scraping your knuckles. So I've shown you kind of what we often encounter, or what your dentist might often encounter when they look inside a mouth. So all of these things, pretty much, you know, we see them often, and they're not, you know, they're not major issues. So what are the things that can actually be issues? So let's look at a few examples. So the differential diagnosis is basically our initial clinical impression. So we're going to come up with a clinical impression. You could have just one, say, oh, I'm for sure, this is candidiasis, this is a yeast infection, I know that's what it is, and I'm not looking at anything else. Or you might have a list of things that you're considering, and then you're going to have to basically go further in your workup to basically kind of rule things out and come out with one diagnosis at the end. But your initial differential diagnosis, that's why we call it a differential diagnosis, might be kind of several things. And it's just based on this history and this visual exam. And so then the next step, once you have kind of this initial list, the treatment plan might call for, or the plan basically to refine your differential diagnosis might call for radiographs, might call for a biopsy, or are we going to prescribe certain medications? And, you know, when are we going to see the patient again? And so there's a plan to refine your differential diagnosis. And once you have a differential diagnosis, kind of a final one, a definitive diagnosis, then you can come up with a treatment plan and what you're going to do about this patient's condition. And this seems pretty obvious, but you'd be surprised how sometimes patients might be treated without a good differential diagnosis. And so then it becomes kind of a guessing game, and lots of different medications are tried when, in fact, you know, you might want to step back and say, well, let's make sure what the differential diagnosis is before we start launching into lots of different treatments. So just some examples here. What I told you before, you could have different types of white lesions. So see, this is a white kind of, it's pretty discreet, but still, this is a white kind of plaque on the border of the tongue. This is the lateral border of the tongue. Here it is another white plaque on the lateral border of the tongue, but it's a bit bigger. Here's another example, also the lateral border of the tongue. And here's kind of a white, sort of webby type lesion on the inside of the cheek, on the buccal mucosa. And these are all completely different. And we're going to know basically, well, in this case, you could say, well, you know, this and this actually looks quite similar to me. But when you collect the history, you're going to learn that this patient is completely healthy, doesn't have any issue, doesn't have any, you know, immunosuppression, doesn't take any medication. But if you look at this patient's teeth, you're going to find a lot of wear on the patient's teeth. And what's happening, the patient is grinding his teeth all the time, and as a result, he is rubbing the edge of his tongue against his teeth, and he's developing what we call frictional keratosis. So frictional keratosis basically is a friction of a tissue against a hard surface causing this white callus. Now, this patient here, once you collect the history, you're going to hear that actually he used to be a heavy smoker, that he still drinks a cup of martinis a day, and that he's actually had this for 9 years. So this is nothing new, and he doesn't have wear facets on his teeth. And this is what we call leukoplakia. Now, leukoplakia is basically a white plaque that cannot be defined as anything else. So it's nothing else that we know. It's just a white plaque. And that white plaque here, if we biopsy it, actually we have to biopsy it, because you can have anything from just what's called hyperkeratosis. The white plaque is basically just the production of keratin. Or you can have what's called dysplasia. Dysplasia is when cells are sort of multiplying in kind of an abnormal fashion. So the cells that are in the epithelium, which is the skin of the mouth, are what's called a squamous epithelium. So you have very nice regular cells. And it makes it really easy if you look at it under the microscope. If you get a biopsy, you look at it under the microscope, you see these very regular cells. Now, if all of a sudden the cells are not as regular and you have lots of, you have too many cells and they've kind of lost their regularity, that's dysplasia. And that dysplasia can be mild, moderate, or severe. And when it becomes severe, all of a sudden, all these cells there that are in the sort of lining of the mouth can start invading the connective tissue, which is right underneath, and that's what we call carcinoma. That's cancer. So it means that this kind of lesion here, this leukoplakia, it's very important that we figure out if this patient has dysplasia, because if there is severe dysplasia in there, that can become cancer. And we want to make sure that we follow this very closely and that we don't, you know, we don't let that happen, or that we catch it very, very early on if it does happen. Whereas this, we if this is on each side of the tongue, we often will say, well, yes, I can see wear facets. This is clinically, there is a source of trauma here. So you might try to actually remove the source of trauma. You might ask the patient's dentist to make a night guard or an occlusal guard so that they stop kind of rubbing their tongue against their teeth, and then that white area will disappear. If it doesn't disappear, you still want to biopsy it to make sure that you didn't miss leukoplakia. So that's just to give you an example, basically, of sort of our reasoning as we kind of go about trying to finalize a diagnosis on these conditions. Now, this down here, this sort of webbing on the buccal mucosa, that's a condition that we call lichen planus. And lichen planus is basically an autoimmune disease where your own body is kind of attacking certain cells in the skin or the inside of the mouth. So it's a mucocutaneous autoimmune inflammatory disease. Now, you've all heard probably of rheumatoid arthritis, you've heard of lupus. Those are very severe autoimmune disease, I mean, very serious autoimmune diseases. Lichen planus is a nuisance. I mean, obviously, it's unpleasant because sometimes the with the white webbing here, you also get a lot of inflammation, a lot of redness, and sometimes you get a lot of ulceration, so it can actually be very painful. But we know how to treat it, and we can control it. So we can't cure it. We can't make it go away. I mean, we can't sort of make it so it never comes back because it's an autoimmune disease, but we can control it so that the patient is comfortable and we control the inflammation. And again, this we will, even though the clinical appearance is very characteristic, we're going to want to confirm that diagnosis with a biopsy to make sure that, you know, our clinical diagnosis is correct. And then this final condition here, when we ask the patient, we're going to ask the history, we're going to go over the medical history. Well, this particular patient happens to be HIV positive. And in patients who are HIV positive, we know that there very often is, when their immune system is quite low, it doesn't happen as much anymore because now there's lots of very successful treatment for HIV infection. So none of the patients we see, at least in this country, who are HIV infected, in a way, get to have, you know, a very, very decreased immune system because the medications that they take will basically prevent that from happening. But in the old days, in the early 90s, when before we had these medications available, sometimes the immune system would really tank. I mean, it would be very, very low. And so this lesion here is called hairy leukoplakia, and it's basically, the Epstein-Barr virus, which is something that lives in 90% of us have Epstein-Barr virus in our tonsils and live perfectly fine with it. I mean, we've been exposed as kids and, you know, it hasn't caused any issues and it doesn't cause an issue now. But in somebody who's very immunosuppressed, that Epstein-Barr virus can somehow get on the side of the tongue here and cause this lesion that we call hairy leukoplakia. And that was actually discovered here by one of my colleagues, Deborah Greenspan, who in the 90s, some of our clinic days, we basically 90% of our patients were HIV positive because we saw there were lots and lots of lesions associated with HIV when it wasn't being controlled by medication. Now, I might see a patient with HIV positive once every other month. It's pretty rare because they are, you know, the medication they're taking now is controlling the various. I mean, basically, a lot of these conditions are what's called opportunistic infections, and these opportunistic infections are under control because their immune systems are a lot stronger with the medications. So these are different examples of these autoimmune diseases, the inflammatory mucocutaneous autoimmune disease that we see in the mouth. And when you look at them, you might say, oh, my goodness, they all look the same. Basically, all these patients have, you know, like terrible ulcers and red gums and ulcers on the gums and ulcers on the lip. I mean, they all look the same. Well, every single one of them is actually a different one. And we won't be able to tell them apart if we don't do a really good history or if we don't get a biopsy for some of them. So now for the three up here, so the first one here is erosive lichen planus. So it's the same lichen planus as what I showed you before, except that's a patient who has much more severe lichen planus, which we call erosive. And you can still see the little kind of white striations there, but this patient also has a lot of ulcerations. And we're going to want to take a biopsy of this to distinguish it from another form of autoimmune disease here, which is called mucous membrane pemphigoid. So pemphigoid is a blistering disease where the immune system is basically attacking what makes the epithelium sort of attached to the connective tissue. And if all of a sudden the immune system is attacking this system, well, the epithelium lifts up and you get blisters. And that's what pemphigoid up here and pemphigus down here, that's what these two conditions are. But again, it's very important to distinguish this from this from this, because even though we're going to treat the mouth the same way, we're going to treat them with either topical corticosteroids or we might treat them with systemic corticosteroids, there might be complications with some of these diseases that are very different from lichen planus. So, for example, somebody who has pemphigoid can also affect the eye, and you can develop a lot of scarring in the eye. So, obviously, we really need to know that this patient is pemphigoid and not lichen planus so that we can send this patient here to the ophthalmologist. So we're going to control their mouth. We're going to treat their mouth and make sure that all these terrible ulcers go away. But we're going to need to send them to an ophthalmologist to make sure that they don't have pemphigoid in their eye. And pemphigus is probably the most severe of those three, also a blistering disease, but that can affect skin, and that can actually leave huge areas of skin basically completely raw. So the skin essentially just kind of sloughs off. Very often it starts in the mouth. So if we diagnose this early enough, then we can make sure that patients start getting treatment and it doesn't start affecting their skin because they're basically already being treated based on their diagnosis from the oral biopsy. Now this here, this is a young patient who comes in, and even though it looks the same as all these other ones, this is an 18-year-old who comes in, feels awful, has a fever, has swollen lymph nodes, has flu-like symptoms, and tells me, oh, I woke up 3 days ago, my mouth was full of these ulcers. And you can see that this patient has, see along the gums here, he's got kind of ulcers along the gums, and he's got an ulcer here. And if I showed you other, you know, pictures of the rest of his mouth, you would see lots of ulcers on the throat and everywhere else. This is not an autoimmune disease. Most autoimmune diseases do not cause fevers and flu-like symptoms. What causes fevers and flu-like symptoms are infections. So this actually is what we call primary herpes. So this is somebody who's never been exposed to herpes before and who all of a sudden get exposed for the first time in their teens. It can actually even happen in your 30s. I've actually seen somebody who developed primary herpes at 50, and let me tell you, that person was really, really ill for a long time because the immune system essentially who has not been, you know, who's never been exposed to this is all of a sudden having a much, much stronger reaction than when it happens earlier. But very often kids, little kids, you know, who play together and they chew toys and share toys, they get exposed to herpes. And they might actually not even get, you know, they get a few little ulcers, but it sometimes doesn't even, you don't even notice it. They get what's called a subclinical infection. But if it happens later in life, in this teenager, then you get basically primary herpetic gingivostomatitis. And once, you know, the herpes virus basically has entered, this will heal. It'll heal within, you know, within 10 days or so. But then the virus will go and kind of lay dormant in what's called the trigeminal ganglion, which is a ganglion kind of in, you know, in the sort of back of your face. And then once in a while, if you have a cold or if you get too much sun or you're tired, that little virus will travel back along the trigeminal nerve and just kind of cause a little cold sore. So people who get cold sores, that's called recurrent herpes or secondary herpes. And it's basically long time ago they got primary herpes at some point or maybe even the subclinical infection, but now they have the virus, and that virus kind of re-expresses itself once in a while. So it's kind of the unwanted guest. So this is basically very different from these three things here, which are autoimmune diseases. And again, we get to that, and we teach our students to get to that from a really good history and a biopsy when needed. So this, I get from the history, I don't need to biopsy this. I make this diagnosis here all from history. And these are the other type of patients that we see. These are actually pretty gory pictures because these are the complications of radiation therapy to the head and neck. So patients who get head and neck cancer, if they have advanced cancer, the surgeon will basically remove that cancer. But then they might need to get radiation therapy because it's not quite enough to essentially cut that cancer out. And while these patients get radiation therapy, they can get a lot of, essentially the radiation will burn the cancer cells, but it also will burn the regular tissue. And that's why you see a lot of, you know, what we call mucositis here coming from the radiation. Now, patients who get head and neck radiation unfortunately get a very dry mouth because it affects the salivary glands on each side. And as a result, they can get a lot of cavities. Now, fortunately, this is a terrible picture, but this really does not have to happen. This happened here because this patient, unfortunately, did not use the daily fluoride that we prescribe to prevent these kind of things. But if we don't pay attention to a patient's teeth and if they have a really dry mouth, this is actually what can happen. And the problem with radiation is if these teeth get extracted, because the patient's bone has lost some of its blood supply, sometimes these extraction sites will not heal. Now, I'm showing you the sort of extreme here, and this here, we basically work very hard at preventing, and we prevent that from seeing patients. This is why we actually see these patients in our clinic before they start the radiation. We see patients in the clinic so that we can, number one, decide which teeth can have a bad prognosis. If they have a tooth that's moving or a tooth that has a lot of decay, we might want to have the surgeon extract this before they get the radiation so that we never have to extract a tooth later. And we will make sure to prescribe a regimen of topical fluoride to these patients so that when the radiation is over, this, as horrible as this looks, basically, as soon as the radiation is over, this will all heal. However, we need to make sure that we really protect the patient's teeth. And in somebody who has a dry mouth, which is, you know, what a radiation will cause, you will get a lot of decay if you don't basically protect the teeth with fluoride. So again, This does not have to happen. This happens if, unfortunately, somebody, you know, does not use a fluoride or does not have access to a dentist and basically has never been told that that he should put fluoride on his or her teeth. But again, all the you were asking before, who treats basically these oral cancers? So we diagnose the cancers, but we don't treat them. We send them to the head and neck surgeons, and there's a whole team of surgeons, radiation oncologists, and medical oncologists who are going to decide what's the best treatment for that patient. And then we participate in this by making sure that we look after the patient's teeth. And so that's why we see these pre-radiation patients in our clinic, because the oncologist knows of, you know, the horrible thing that can happen if these patients are not followed by a dentist. So they basically, we prevent this from happening by making sure that these patients are using fluoride on a regular basis and that their dentist knows that they had radiation, and that the dentist should be careful basically with what they do. So let me give you an example of differential diagnosis. So this is a 60-year-old man who's referred by his physician for evaluation of a non-healing painful ulcer. And the ulcer has been present for 2 months. That's a long time. There's been no change in size or pain, and there's been no prior treatment. This is somebody who's in good general health. He doesn't take any current medication, has no known allergies, has vital signs that are, well, a little borderline. His blood pressure is a bit high here, but overall, he's in good general health. But he's a heavy smoker. He's been smoking a pack a day for 45 years, or he has a 45-pack year history, drinks a couple of martinis a day. And he has not seen a dentist in 30 years. Long time. And I wish actually I had taken a picture of what his lower teeth looked like, because there's a lot of calculus that builds up over 30 years. And this is what his tongue looks like. And you can see this ulcer here. If I touch this with my gloved finger, it actually feels quite firm. Now, when you're a dentist or you're used to looking in the patient's mouth, a non-healing ulcer, which is firm like this, always raises this red flag because, you know, a lot of people say, oh, this is probably cancer. And one might be right. However, we wonder, you know, so what are we going to do? Are we going to immediately biopsy this to make sure this is not cancer? Or are we going to, when we continue our exam, we find that, unfortunately, this patient has a lot of broken down teeth. And it's hard to see here because of the saliva, but basically this little edge here is extremely sharp. So it could just be that this patient basically has been rubbing his tongue against that really sharp tooth and that the tongue just doesn't have a chance to heal. So before I rush in there and start taking a biopsy, I'm just going to basically smooth that really sharp edge off, right? And I will see, obviously, the patient a week later. And if that also is still there, then, of course, I would jump on it and biopsy it. But a week later, actually, it was looking a lot better. And 2 weeks later, it's completely gone. So this is an example, basically, of a traumatic ulcer that was just caused by this really sharp edge. Again, the history, we look at the other teeth. I mean, this helps us kind of cinch down the diagnosis, right? Of course, had he not healed, then we would have biopsied it. So now, another example here of 39-year-old woman who, same chief complaint as our 60-year-old patient, non-healing ulcer. She has severe pain, and she said the pain kind of radiated back into her throat. And she has had this for 4 months. The pain has actually increased since it started. She's been previously seen by a ear, nose, and throat doctor who prescribed an antifungal medication, thinking maybe it was a yeast infection, then gave her acyclovir as a medication to actually treat herpes, thinking maybe she had herpes. There's been no response. And she's in good general health. She doesn't take any current medications, no known allergies. She's never smoked, doesn't drink, is not immunosuppressed. And she gets regular dental care. And this is what her tongue looks like. Doesn't look all that different, does it? Look at this ulcer here. You know, looks like kind of very similar type of ulcer. But now her teeth are pristine. She doesn't have any broken teeth. She doesn't have – there's no reason for her to have that ulcer, especially for 4 months. So this is the kind of thing where you immediately say, well, there is no reason for her to have this ulcer. I don't see any sharp edges. There is – she can't be possibly biting her tongue for 4 months. So that's one you immediately biopsy. And unfortunately, this turned out to be a squamous cell carcinoma, which is the most common cancer in the mouth. And – but you can see that – basically, these two cases, you know, they look clinically quite similar, right? But they have a very different history. And so basically that's what we do, and that's what we teach our students, to make sure they recognize a difference between this and this once they're graduate and they're out there in private practice. So we don't expect them necessarily some students are really, you know, they want to learn how to biopsy, and later on when they're in private practice, they will do biopsies, and that's perfectly fine. And I'll show you what a biopsy looks like. It's not a very invasive procedure. But they may not want to. I mean, they may want to focus on teeth. But what we really want them to learn and what we train them to do, even if they don't biopsy themselves, is that if this here does not respond to their, you know, smoothing down the sharp cusp, they immediately send that patient for biopsy. And this one here, they immediately recognize this has been there for 4 months. There's no reason for this also to be there. This patient has to go in to the oral medicine clinic and get a biopsy. And they don't start trying to treat it with different things because there is no reason for this ulcer to be there for 4 months. So that's what we teach our students, to make sure that they don't sort of sit on stuff thinking, well, let me try this and let me try that. This is something that needs to be. Time is of an essence in cases like this, and you want to try to diagnose them when they're still small enough that they can get treated just with surgical removal and the patient will not need radiation therapy. So let me show you what a biopsy looks like. So basically, so this is just this little kind of, you know, warty looking lesion here. And we're going to, this is basically just local anesthetic. So we're going to, you know, put a little paste, which I'm sure you've had when you go to the dentist, you know, it tastes like banana or mint or whatever, daiquiri, whatever the flavor of the topical anesthetic is. So you put this little paste, then you inject a little bit of anesthetic, and when the patient is numb, you use this little, so this instrument here is a disposable instrument. It's called a punch biopsy, and it's essentially, it looks like a tiny little cookie cutter, and basically you just kind of cut out a little disc of tissue, and it leaves, you know, it gives you kind of this little circular incision here, and then you can just lift it and sort of cut it at the base. And that's basically what the pathologist needs to be able to make a diagnosis. So this little specimen here, so it'll leave a little hole, and it's not a big deal. I mean, that little hole will stop bleeding if we put pressure on it, you know, within a few minutes. And then it'll kind of heal nicely. If it bleeds a little bit more, we can always put a little stitch there, but most of the time we don't need to put a stitch. So it's a pretty benign procedure. And that's a little specimen that's going to go in a special medium. That's going to be, it's like a bottle with a liquid, and that's going to get sent to the pathologist. And the way it's going to get basically sort of treated in order for the pathologist to look at it, they're going to embed it in paraffin, a little block of paraffin. And once the paraffin is set, you can actually cut really, really thin slices, like kind of, you know, micro millimeter slices, and then stain. And that's basically what the pathologist will look at. They'll look at little slices of this tissue so that they can sort of see under the microscope what's going on in a given lesion. So oral medicine is a pretty important specialty that's at the interface of dentistry and medicine. And I think you'll agree with me that after seeing all this, the comprehensive history is absolutely critical to the diagnosis, and also multidisciplinary approach is very often required for an optimal treatment outcome. So that's why we work with all these different specialties. And now I'll be happy to take questions. Yes.
Doctor, in your clinic, when the time comes to write the treatment plan, Dr. Sharma was here recently, and he said that preference is that the residents and students help the patient basically write their own treatment plan, personalize the experience as much. Some of your attendings disagree. They feel that the patient can never have enough education to make an effective treatment plan. And some of these things affect insurance. What is your preference?
So first of all, we actually have a slightly different clinic than postgrad pros or perio or ortho, where we have postgraduate residents who actually will be treating patients. In our clinic, the students will help us collect the history, so they learn how to collect the history, but the attending always decides on the treatment plan. And the patients are basically, I mean, they're, you know, even though the students and residents help us with the history, we come up with a treatment plan. Now, your question was, what about the patient's involvement in the treatment plan? Sometimes there's a choice, you know. You could do this treatment or you could do that treatment. I'm going to give you actually that's really my personal answer, my personal opinion. In the U.S., I think there is a lot of fear about liability, and I have noticed that very often physicians will provide all these options, say, well, okay, so you could do this or this or this, but they won't say what they think you should do. And I feel that often it's very difficult for a patient to decide what to do. So in my training, I was originally trained in France. I went to dental school in France, but I did my oral medicine here. But I think I probably retained a bit more of my, I mean, I will tell patients what I would do if they were my mom or my dad, I would recommend this. So I give them the option, but I basically will tell them, you know, if you were my relative, this is what I would do. But that's a very personal thing. Everyone kind of has a different way of doing this.
Just two brief questions. You mentioned your imaging, your photography. Are you doing that with just digital cameras?
Yes.
Second question. Dean Featherstone was here recently, and he encouraged all of us to go and get prescription toothpaste and other tools. We actually need someone to write the prescription. How do we get that?
With your dentist.
But, I mean, if we're in the clinic...
Oh, if you so
707, and he said, come in to 707 and get.
Oh yes, then the students will get the attending to sign the prescription. Oh yeah, you can get. I mean, basically for fluoride toothpaste, and yes, absolutely. And yes, I use a digital camera with a microscopic lens and ring flash. Yes, and by the way, every single picture we take in clinic, patients do sign an informed, basically a consent form that they're consenting. And of course, you know, we never, you know, you can never recognize patients based on these pictures, but we still get consent from our patients when we take pictures, and they know that we might use those for teaching or. By the way, the case of granulomatous polyangiitis, that case we ended up publishing. Because it was a very interesting case, and I think we publish these cases when we feel that other clinicians can learn from it. So you want, if it's rare, you want to basically publish it so that people can learn, other people can learn from it.
What is the exact name of the clinic that you're working in to be differentiated from all the other?
The oral medicine clinic. Oral medicine. Basically is like dermatology of the mouth.
So if I had something in my mouth and my dentist said, well, I think you should have somebody take a look at it, I could get an appointment.
That's right.
The oral medicine clinic.
That's right. And you can look it up. I mean, you could Google oral medicine UCSF. I mean, I'm happy to give you the phone number of the clinic, but you can find it and how to get to us and everything.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.